Did you miss us when we were away? Did you hang our pictures on the wall? Hello, and welcome back to Big Mouth, the thinking time wasters pop culture talk show. We've been on our holidays, well, Matt has, and we're back to educate, inform, and entertain. My name's Andrew Harrison, and this week we'll be looking at Sky Arts' new documentary series, The Agony and the Ecstasy, which covers the formative years of the acid house scene in the late 1980s. It's catnip to aging ravers like me, but have we heard this story one too many times, and is there anything new to add? We'll also be listening to the new album by Philadelphia cosmic rock wanderers, The War on Drugs. Their latest release has the somewhat discouraging title, A Deeper Understanding. Is it up there with the mind-surfing niceness of Lost in the Dream? Or are they just a slightly smackier version of Dire Straits? We'll also be looking at a deeply peculiar Mexican horror movie called The Untamed and catching up on some of the movies that we missed. And of course, we'll be listening to our guests' favourite new tunes as well. So let's meet the guests. We have two Big Mouth newcomers for you today. Linda Marek is a film critic for Hey You Guys and the editor of screenwords.co.uk. She's a film studies graduate, so unlike most of us, she knows what she's on about for a change.
Get her off.
Sick of experts. Linda loves her intelligent sci-fi, and her favourite movie is Brazil, so she is our kind of person. Hello, Linda. Welcome to Big Mouth. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
So tell us what Hey You Guys is, because I keep saying it on film posters all the time.
Hey You Guys is basically probably one of the most popular online websites, outlets for film. Mm. And they mostly do news, reviews, interviews, and they get thousands of hits.
It's like a parallel world, isn't it? Because I mean, when you're old like me and you're brought up in the world of magazines, if it's not in print, doesn't count. Mm. He says, hosting a podcast. It's like an entire different world of stuff, and it's interesting to me that you see just as many quotes on posters from Hey,
and even
things like Amazon reviews and tweets now.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. Also with us, another Big Mouth virgin. Speaking of try before you buy, it's Rob Fitzpatrick, who is now senior producer at Spotify, where he puts together radio playlists and other weird projects for the streaming colossus. Rob is also a veteran of the good old The Word magazine. Hello, Rob. Welcome to Big Mouth. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you.
Now, we were talking about film reviewing.
Yes.
Like, you cannot try.
Can I interrupt slightly? Because actually, I also studied film studies, but at college.
You know what you're talking about as well.
At college, so it don't really count because I was about 17.
Right.
And I don't think I passed.
Plus, we're not going to ask you anything about it.
But I did watch some Hitchcock films.
Okay. But that's all you need to do to be. Yeah.
So there you go. So, I've got.
You can spell Tartovsky, that's the main thing. Yeah.
Love a bit of Tartovsky.
I always thought with the movies, there ought to be the option to pay at the end, right? So if you think it's rubbish, you can go out and get three quarters of your money back. Mm-hmm. There's no try before you buy in the movies. Try before you buy has completely overturned music criticism, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why bother to read 2,000 words or even 300 when you can go and check it out on Spotify?
Mm.
Do you think is there still a point in criticising pop music?
No.
From a read? You don't think it's at all? All right.
Well, no, see you later. No, I thought it was interesting in your intro when you said that if it's not in print, it doesn't count.
Mm.
And I would go, if it's not online, it doesn't count. Or I would perhaps go so far as to say, if it is in print, it doesn't count.
Mm.
Just to be deliberately difficult.
Well, I suppose it's because the purpose is, doesn't it? Is the purpose to make you go and buy the record or not buy the record? Or is the purpose to give you an entertaining read? And I kind of think if you pick up The Guardian on a Friday and Alexis Petridis has written a really interesting read, or Dory and Linsky has written a really... Then what you're actually consuming and enjoying is the read. It's not, do I or do not buy this record? In a lot of ways, it's like book reviews in the Sunday papers, so you know what to say about all the millions of books you'll never read.
And that's exactly it. I read whatever Alexis is writing about, whether or not I'm interested in what he's writing about.
Totally.
Because there's always going to be a turn of phrase or something in there that will make you laugh like a drain. And I think, that's what it needs to be now.
Yeah, no, I think that, I suppose what it is there's two very distinct worlds. Mm. And the magazine, and the confusion comes between trying to mix them up, because actually what magazines do is they want you to buy the magazine or the newspaper and tell you an interesting story.
Yeah.
And what someone like Spotify wants you to do is just listen to the music. And there's two different things.
It was in the 80s, and it was with the advent of Q and Empire, really, that the review turned into a buyer's guide rather than read the thing for its own entertainment. And in fact, when you look at your Facebook page every day, people are actually posting reviews of things, going, what an amazing review this is, or what a terrible review this is. Here's an interesting read. But anyway, you heard him just then, by the way. I'm going to introduce the third leg of the, the fourth leg, rather, of the wobbly table that is Big Mouth. It's our producer, ensuring that our audio offering is of the highest quality. The Alan Bloom line of podcasts Matt Hall. Hello, Matt, how are you?
I'm fine, but I don't think the loading coil can take it.
Absolutely. All right, we'll just give it, just, I don't know, turn it down a notch or two. Okay, listeners, before we get started, just a little reminder. If you use an Apple device, why not subscribe to Big Mouth via Apple Podcasts? You can use the app on your phone or the iTunes Music Store. And while you're there, why not give us a lovely review and a nice star rating, because it really helps us. But of course, not to offend Rob, you can also get Big Mouth on Spotify.
Thank you very much.
We're in the podcast section, aren't we? Where is the podcast section on Spotify?
You will see it there on the homepage.
Right, okay. How many podcasts is Spotify hosting these
Thousands.
Days? Thousands, yeah. Right. Okay, before we get into the films and the music, you may have noticed this week that Wednesday the 16th of August was the 40th anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley, a weirdly sad event in that it wasn't really marked the way other big rock anniversaries are marked. In December 2019, it'll be wall-to-wall memorials for the 40th anniversary of John Lennon's death, but Elvis is receding into history as his fans age out. Could it have been another way if certain things hadn't happened the way they did? We're going to talk about that in a minute after a bit of Elvis. From the Sun Sessions, this is Trying to Get to You.
I've been travelling over miles, even through the valleys too. I've been travelling night and day, I've been running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. Ever since I read your letter, where you said you loved me true.
Elvis Presley with Trying to Get to You, which, pop fact, Paul McCartney ripped off and turned into In Spite of All the Danger, the very first song written by the Quarrymen.
Right.
I know this because I read it on Wikipedia. So poor old Elvis seems to be fading into history. You know, other things from 50 years ago and, you know, 40 years ago are still very current. And Elvis just seems to be part of your granddad's world, doesn't
there's it? A really good piece in the Washington Post this week. Mm. Which basically is headlined and posited that Elvis died at just the wrong time.
Yeah.
In that he died after he was really fat, or when he was really fat, and just
he actually died of being really fat.
Well,
if you know,
he died of a heart attack, yeah. but he died when punk rock was just coming along, so everyone was kind of, you know, no Elvis, Beatles or the Rolling Stones. He died when what people remembered of him was jumpsuits and fat and sweaty. He didn't, if he'd lived just kind of 10 years later.
Yeah.
It would have been all sharp suits. Okay, let's just do a bit of corporate, go and do a bit of gospel for a while, come back, have a Johnny Cash reissue.
Mm-hmm.
Bob's your uncle, but he died when he was...
He died pre-nostalgia.
Yeah.
He did, yes. Yeah. Well, I blame Colonel Tom Parker for this, because Colonel Tom Parker...
that sounds like a link.
He is. It was a link. A professional in this game. Elvis never got to do a proper comeback, apart from, you know, the Elvis comeback isn't really a comeback in the contemporary. He never got to do Johnny Cash. You're absolutely right. He never got lined up with... I mean, inevitably, it would have involved Jack White, but, you know, never mind. You can't have everything. You know, partly because... I think chiefly because Tom Parker... made him make awful movies, then imprisoned him in Vegas, enabled that awful lifestyle. We never got a British tour. We never, you know, Elvis, towards the end of his life, wanted to get back touring again, was not physically capable. So if this is the conceit, if you've got a time travel ticket, if you've got a TARDIS, I would use my time travel ticket to go back to February the 6th, 1955, to the Ellis Auditorium in Memphis, and I'd shove Colonel Tom Parker in a cupboard, or I'd kidnap Elvis. I'd prevent that meeting from happening, because without the malign influence of Colonel Tom Parker, we would have had a different Elvis. Mm. But also, we would not have had the archetype of the fat, sweaty, ruined rock star to react against. We would have looked at Elvis as a cool figure. He may even have been a kind of quite a sharp figure. He may have been a figure of, you know, slight kitsch, but it would have been the kind of respectable kitsch of Burt Bacharach. So that's where my TARDIS ticket would go. Now, Linda.
Well, I'm going to be very predictable, because when you asked me this yesterday, the first thing I thought about straight away was Blake and Amy.
Right.
And I wish Amy Winehouse had never met Blake, because she'd still be alive if she hadn't got into that whole drug sort of culture. But then again, I straight away came back to you and said, well, if she hadn't met him, we wouldn't have had such beautiful albums.
Yeah,
from
you wouldn't
her
have rocked up Back to Black, would you?
Exactly. But I mean, I'd rather have Amy alive than very successful.
Making
in all honesty,
Frank too.
So very successful and dead, versus an alive Amy who could perhaps be still making music now. So it's kind of...
Yeah, I've got to say, I think Amy Winehouse guy that had the kind of addictive personality that she would have kind of... I mean, she was kind of quite far down that road before any of that happened.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I have a completely... I mean, just, you know, just from watching the As If Capaldi...
You're on Team Amy rather than...
I am very, very Team Amy. You know, I adored her and I used to see her a lot around London. I used to... around Shoreditch, and she was such a lovely person, and I was completely devastated when she died because it could have been avoided.
Yeah, I think you're onto something, because, I mean, yeah, she did have an addictive personality. She was always a riotous boozer, but he really did enable an awful lot of it. It's enabling
I agree.
Welcome to the Big Mouth Therapy Session. Yeah, so maybe, but then, as you say, would we have had a string of kind of like, you know, Fender Rhodes Jazz, Frank 2 and 3s? Yeah.
But I would much rather she was alive. I could take all them. You could take anything away, and just to have that person
just
back.
To have her God almighty.
Also,
that's worth
it. No Adele.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
The butterfly wing would have kind of, what would be the need?
Rob, what's your TARDIS time travel?
Well, talking of butterfly wings, I mean, I spent a lot of time thinking about this yesterday, and then I just thought all roads lead to Rome. And I thought, you know, Woolerton Village Fate, 1957.
Yes.
Lennon and McCartney. Stop a meeting. Stop the meeting. And not because, listen, I grew up on all that, and I love all of that. But wouldn't it be amazing to live in a world where the Beatles hadn't happened? And that's not to run them down, because I love them, right? They created everything that the point is they created everything that we know, right?
Yes.
We've done this. They created everything that we understand about pop music starts with them. The reason why Elvis, nobody gives a monkeys about him, and this is Mark Ellen's thing, pre-Beatles, nobody cares. Right. If you're pre-Beatles, doesn't matter.
But if you'd asked the Beatles, they would have said,
"Yeah, I know."
No,
well, exactly. But nobody.
No Beatles,
but yeah, of course, all of that lot care about that, but nobody else does. Mm. And but if you stop them, in it, you know, it's butterfly on the path, treading its wings. It's that the entire world that we understand as cultural,
so you're like
music.
You're the bloke who voted Brexit just to see what would happen, aren't you? This
that's
is a kind
all,
of nihilistic,
terrible,
crazy
terrible.
Idea.
No, I know.
Robin, the man in the high castle with Rob Fitzpatrick.
Because Elvis, Chuck Berry, all of those guys would still be around. Maybe, I mean, I was kind of thinking of the same thing. I was thinking, what would have happened if Stuart Sutcliffe hadn't left the Beatles?
Wow.
You know, good because, one. You know, well, if he didn't have a brain tumour, if he hadn't...
had his head kicked in a Scottish pub car park.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, would that... They would have been the Velvet Underground. You know, they wouldn't have gone down those, ties and bowl haircuts. Yeah. They'd have been James Dean's slick back hair.
But they would then be being an alternative to a thing that didn't exist.
Because you'd still have had Lennon and McCartney making, you know, writing songs, changing the face of how pop songs are written and performed. But you'd have had this kind of art school, cool outsider with a German girlfriend going, why don't we do this? You know, he'd have been like the Andy Warhol to...
To make it even darker, what about, and this is a horrible thing to say, but I mean, what about if that drunk policeman hadn't have met John Lennon's mum by the way of running her over and killing her, and then creating a person, then thereby creating a person who is entirely different, worldview...
If Lennon's mum had lived, basically.
If Lennon's mum had lived, right? So that person that don't even know each other didn't meet in the most violent and horrendous way. And then that creates a world where you don't have this massively bitter, angry, fucked up guy who goes on to meet this other guy whose mum also died, and then, shit, all we've got is each other.
Yeah.
Or what about if John Lydon...
There's a pitch in there, Netflix. Just give me a call anytime you like.
What about if John Lydon had really good teeth when he was a child?
What about if John Lydon's mum had been a dentist?
But what about if John Lydon... he had a bout of polio, didn't he?
Yeah.
So what if he hadn't...
No, it wasn't polio. It was spinal meningitis.
What?
Right.
That's what John Lydon had.
This is a laugh in a minute.
Disappointing follow-up to Spinal Tap.
Absolutely, yes. Well, viewers, if you're interested in changing the history of rock, pop, and indeed entertainment, please go on the Facebook page, give us your suggestions. Perhaps we can do some follow-ups next week and see what people came up with. Okay, let's get back to the enormously contemporary with a documentary about the events of 30 years ago. Presented by Norman J. MBE, The Agony and the Ecstasy recounts the story of the genesis of house music, a subject on which notoriously little original footage is available. Can this documentary surmount the limitations of the fact that there's only a few grainy clips of people bumbling around in warehouses, and can it add more to the story? Before we talk about it, let's get in the mood with the greatest acid track of all, according to me. This is Lack of Love by Charles B.
Ugh.
Lack of Love by Charles B, setting the scene for the Sky Arts Channel's new three-part documentary, The Agony and the Ecstasy. Linda Marrick, now you are a bit on the young side for the rave. Are you, you a cheesy quaver on, your, on
well,
the, on
I
the
was,
side?
Actually, yes, I was for at least 10 years of my life. I was a raver. I got into it, I mean, slightly later than most people, sort of around 93, 94. I'd say about 93, 94.
Everyone else in this room.
It was the usual sort of Saturday night going to a club thing, and I eventually moved on to the squat party scene.
Oh, yes. Did you have a dog on a string?
No, I didn't. No. I wasn't a crusty. I wasn't an arts quarter.
Oh, right. Arts squatter.
An arts quarter, yes.
Very good. Now, what did you make of The Agony and the Ecstasy?
I thought there was what lacked in it was ravers themselves talking about it. I thought it was okay having all the DJs from the time, and I loved listening to the music, but I mean, why not ask people who were there at the time, you know?
I mean, the conceit of it is that they make up for the lack of any original footage by restaging things in a very slick manner.
Oh, yes, I didn't like that at all, I must say.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it made it look... I thought it gave it an element of class, but also artificiality that's missing in other things like this. Because you've got all these slow-mo shots of beautiful people waving their fingers in their face and people DJing in slow-mo while lasers go off kind of thing to fill in for the fact that basically we've got, you know, 20 minutes of footage of Castle Morton and like 10 seconds of the Hacienda.
Yeah, I didn't get on with the reenactment at all.
The worst one was the bit where Judge Jules and Norman Jay were talking about how they kind of hooked up in the warehouse party scene and started putting on their own things, and they had a kind of reenactment soft focus of a young white guy and a young black guy giving each other a kind of soul clap
and then running down the street
and it was
I thought that was like rather embarrassing, to be honest with you. I didn't like that. I mean, it's, some might find it a little bit, you know, endearing but I didn't like it at all.
I thought that, you know, they did have loads of photos, and it made me think of the recent BBC series where they actually kind of tracked down people who'd been involved in, who weren't famous, but had been part of scenes and kind of spoke to them now. And it did make me think, especially when right at the very beginning, there's a very famous photo that came up of Rocky from Rocky and Diesel as a punter with long kind of hair and stuff. And I was thinking, that's not difficult to identify that person and talk to him, and you know there are loads of people who are still around and have those photos and are in those photos, and that would have been part of the thing about it, was the democracy of the scene.
Rob, what did you make of it? This is more my and your end of things, isn't it? What did you think?
I thought an awful lot about this. First of all, I thought it was confused in what it was trying to do. So it was a lot of different things. As a documentary, I thought when you watch it, you go, well, is it a documentary about Norman Jay? Or is it a documentary about Acid House? Or is it a documentary about the People's Acid House? Like, the People's Acid House is a more interesting documentary than this, right?
Yeah.
Well, they also conflated a lot of things, because they had the warehouse party scene, which Jules and Norman came out of, which happened a good few years before Acid House came on the scene.
That was my initial thought about the whole thing, was I could not be more respectful or love Norman Jay more, but you do not... Norman Jay and Acid House are not the same thing, right?
No,
it's just not the same thing. Mm. And there's no... Obviously, he was there. Obviously, he was doing things. But it felt to me... fundamentally, I thought that it was confused, right? As what is the point of this? What is it you're trying to tell us? Secondly, I thought that one of the handicaps of this thing, and as me and you know, having worked for dance music magazines and interviewed a lot of DJs, DJs don't tend to be very interesting people. Right? Yeah. They're just not. But also the other thing, there's a fundamental problem with something like this, in the sense that what you're talking about is blokes playing other blokes' records to other blokes, right? Mm. So there's no creation story, because they didn't make the stuff they're playing.
That's true, but I mean, there is the story of putting it all together and going to the place.
Yeah,
my problem with it is that I've actually heard the story of how we went to Ibiza and we just Ian came back and invented it in London. I've heard it too many times.
Yeah, that's true. But this is the one of the other problems with the documentary, is that you could take this thing, and why not take someone who is bang up to date and get them to tell this story to people who aren't 106 years old.
Yeah.
You know, so then you've got a thing where you go, you shoot and you go, this is why it's interesting to you, rather than sit back, granddad, put your slippers on, here's Charles B. You know, which is what they're doing, right?
The feeling I got for it was it's very much kind of like my generation's version of my parents' generation banging on about 1968 and 1967.
Totally. I expect it will get a little bit better towards sort of every week because, I mean, it's doing it chronologically. I think, let's see what they do.
But I thought there were some really, really interesting threads in there that could have followed up. One, you talk about the fact that there's hardly any footage. One of the tiny little things I thought that was absolutely brilliant, and you think that's a film in itself. There was a tiny little clip of footage of these people coming into a room and they're talking about Krausman, and they're all, it's like someone's just thrown open the doors of a warehouse, and there's about 20 people coming in, and they're like that. They're like, I mean, they might be on drugs.
Robert's grinning like a maniac.
But the point is, they look like they're the youngest, happiest, most up for it, most excited people you've ever seen in your life. Genuine. Fuck me, excitement, right? That's what it's about.
Yeah.
And it's not, Groove Rider did this great quote when he was saying about, I don't want to go up north, it'll talk funny and all that. And it's all,
it's going to be crap, it's not London.
And there's a subtext to that, which is, I don't know what I'm going to get when I'm up there. I don't know how I'm going to be treated when I'm up there. But then he goes and got there and everyone was brilliant and it was amazing and it went off. And you go, that's a story, right? That's a story that's worth telling. Those micro stories are much more interesting.
There was a great, a little short thing that Channel 4 did for, I think it's an E4 online thing, and we talked about it on an earlier podcast, and it was a micro story. It was the genesis of house music on one block in Chicago. And it was a little 20-minute thing, and they had no footage. It was all animated black and white pictures. You know, it was the Ken Burns effect, you know, when the camera moves around on a still photograph and you get that sort of sense of history. And they just told the story of that tiny, tiny coterie of people who accidentally invented this amazing thing.
Yeah.
And because there were events and because you hadn't heard it all before, it was actually riveting. Whereas this, I felt that the generation that's going to be watching it has already heard it. And the generation that needs to hear it probably not going to be watching it.
Mm.
I did think, however, I'm going to give thumbs up to Mark Moore for his,
Mark Moore was really funny, lovely bloke.
Why don't you play fast music? Well, you can't sniff poppers. Why do gay people in the house when you can't sniff poppers to hip hop? Can you?
Yeah.
That's all good stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Like he gave the also, best quotes.
Yeah, he was great.
He was the greatest.
He popped, as they say.
Yeah.
When are they going to use Dave Beer's photo as a kid? Don't do this.
I would watch the Dave Beer story because the tale of Back to Basics in Leeds and on the whole of the North actually is not just exciting and interesting, but it hasn't been told and done to death like this one.
I interviewed Dave Beer once in a pub not far from here, and it was meant to be, he made a record. I was terrible like that shit. But he was a really amazing guy just to spend a couple of hours with hearing these stories.
I think the word is a character.
Yes.
I think that's what we refer to.
Yeah.
I think it would be interesting in later episodes if they touch on the sort of the Jibber sound systems and people like that, you know, like Spiral Tribe and, you know.
Tales we haven't heard before.
I really hope they do that because that story has not really been told properly. And every time there is a documentary like that, they always sort of, you know, brush past it and they don't really delve into it because there are sort of really interesting stories to be told there.
The Agony and the Ecstasy is on Sky Arts, available on demand, so you can watch it whenever you like, and there's another two episodes to come, including Goldie as a judge with a wig on and a gavel, so that'll be entertaining. Okay, let's move on. As you know, we ask our guests to bring in a tune each and to tell us about it, an editor's recommendation, if you don't mind. Linda Marek, what have you got for us?
I have a song by Jeanne Moreau, Le Tourbillon, which features in Jules et Jim, a François Truffaut French New Wave movie. And I picked it because, you know...
Because you can pronounce French really well. That's why you picked it.
because as we all know, Jeanne Moreau died a couple of weeks ago. And she's one of the... For me, she epitomises everything that's beautiful about Frenchness and French women. She's elegant, classy, free spirit. She's serious but also very playful, and I absolutely love the way she sings the song because you can almost hear her smile through the song. I absolutely adore this song.
So, okay, well, show us another show where you're going to get Acid House and Jeanne Moreau. Here we go. Jeanne Moreau, Le Tourbillon.
Elle avait des bagues à chaque doigt, des tas de bracelets autour des poignets, et puis elle chantait avec une voix qui cite au manjola.
Elle avait des yeux d'opale, qui me fascinaient. Il y avait l'ovale de son visage pâle, de femme fatale qui me fut fatale, de femme fatale qui me fut fatale. On s'est connus, on s'est reconnus, on s'est perdu de vue.
I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it properly. It's John Moreau with a tourbillon from the soundtrack of Jules Et.
John Moreau.
John Moreau, yeah.
Never heard of him.
Yeah, I think we'll pull a signing before the end of the transfer window. Anyway, our guest, Linda Marek, bringing a bit of class to the podcast for a change. We should have that on our sister podcast, Romaniacs, the Brexit podcast, available now at audioboom.com/channel/Romaniacs-podcast and on Spotify too, Rob.
Yes, it is on Spotify,
it's
people.
It's on Spotify. Okay, let's move on. The War on Drugs. Rather hit the spot with their third album, Lost in the Dream, back in 2013. Its mix of shard shimmering rock, Balearic tranciness, and deep depression seemed more complex than other big rock aspirants, and more substantial than your average indie moaner. 3 years later, they're back with a deeper understanding, and we're going to talk about it after this track. This is called Holding On. The War on Drugs with Holding On. That was straight up Arcade Fire, was it not? Another addition to the proud Big Mouth list of records I thought I'd hate but didn't actually mind in the end. Rob, what did you make of The War on Drugs?
I loved The War on Drugs record for good and bad reasons.
Yes.
I mean, I loved it. I mean, I am literally a fan of The War on Drugs, and I love the fact that they will release, you know, like 11-minute singles that are... It's just fantastically good. And I also hate myself. I hate myself for loving it.
Why do you hate yourself for loving it?
Because...
And stop kicking the table, because the listeners will be annoyed.
I can't help it. It's that self-hate. Because I feel that I'm being emotionally manipulated in the most glorious, painful way.
Isn't that what
them.
Pop music is for?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it is. It is. And some, but, you know, pop music can also be a complete bastard, and it can get you... And there's a track on this album, beautiful little intro, and then there's this little guitar figure that could have come from, you know, a sort of 1983 REM album or something, and it just when I was listening to it yesterday, and it was just, it got me it was like seeing an old photo that you hadn't seen before, or you hadn't seen for 35 years.
It get you right in the feels.
It got me right in the feels, and I think, you bastard, because it's brilliant and terrifying at the same time.
This is the AM rock of the 21st century, isn't it?
I mean,
a yacht rock man at heart.
Yeah. Well, in a way, yes. Oh. But actually, I thought the name that popped into my head when I was listening to it a lot yesterday was Bryan Adams.
Yeah.
Because there's that... Because there's that tone in his voice. It's not quite gone the full Rod Stewart, but we're on our way there.
Right, Lennon Merrick.
And it's great.
Yeah.
I didn't get on with it. I mean, I'm not a fan of The War on Drugs. I'm really sorry. Again, I really couldn't remove the sound of Bryan Adams from my head because that kind of ruined it for me. I think some of the tracks, he sounds a bit like Tom Petty, which is a little bit better. It's not really for me because it's a little bit too melodic, too perfect sounding. The rock that I like is a bit wonky. I like it a bit punky. I mean, you're talking to someone who thinks Up the Bracket by the Libertines is one of the greatest albums ever made. And it's,
oh, my God.
Do you not like the Libertines? It just sounded a little bit too perfect, and I just couldn't get into it. It didn't say anything to me about my life, as they say. So,
well, I think you're right in that it is fundamentally about the soundscaping. It sounds enormous, doesn't it? How do you pronounce him? Adam Granduciel? Is that the main guy's dad? How do you pronounce him? I'm not entirely sure. Let's say it is. Adam Granduciel is a wonk. You know, he really knows his rock history inside out,
and will
transplant a bit of Neil Young and a bit of, as you say, Tom Petty. Yeah. What surprises me is that this stuff, which is very much, you know, your parents' record collection, seems to be connecting with the millennials. They're really into it.
They can't remember the originals. That's why they're into it.
I think they have more access to the originals than they've ever had before.
They've got more access to the originals than we had. We had to go out and buy this stuff if we wanted it.
If you want to be kind of completely brutal as well, it's out of context. It's rootless. It's just a thing on a screen. Yeah. I mean,
the thing about this record is, I think that if it has an emotional connection to you, you can't help but go, oh God, yeah, all right, you win. All right, yeah, this is great. Yeah, yeah. Because you can't deny the fact that he's hitting every one of your buttons. And if you don't, which is the reverse of your
then
Libertines thing,
you
then
than,
if I if I hear the Libertines, I think if anybody over the age of 35 is a Libertine, so just go, oh, piss off, Libertines. Absolute load of old shit. Anybody under the age of 35 goes, what the fuck are you talking about, Grandad? Yeah. This is the greatest band ever. And I think that this is like the other way around of that. Yeah. Whatever you think about them, if you are of a certain age, they'll get you because everything is
dirty
everything
around
is perfect.
The edges. Yeah. I don't like it perfect.
I mean,
I don't think it is perfect.
I didn't get the Brian Adams thing. I had a lot of Bob Dylan kind of coming through in his kind of like, you know, just the tone of voice and whatever.
Yeah.
But Andrew mentioned it as being Balearic. I totally agree with that. I listened to it like 3 or 4 times, kind of outside in the garden when I was good. I couldn't tell you one lyric or song, but as a soundscape, as something which kind of drifted really nicely. Yeah. And I did think, you know, watching kind of last night when we were talking about the Acid House thing, they would be perfect in a kind of Ibethan sunset.
Totally.
Sat by a pool.
Working, I mean, an Alfredo.
For a recovery session.
Yeah. Kind of, having said that, I did have one of the tunes in my head for the last 3 days, which is track 4, I think it's called Stranger Things, which I quite liked. But again, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's either going to get you or it isn't. Yeah. I mean, I was surprised that because I would usually ordinarily, you know, cordially loathe this kind of music. And I was rather swept along, partly because it has got that. I mean, you can get away with murder under the umbrella of Balearic, can't you? Partly because it's got that. But I was also quite interested in, you know, he's got, you know, Rob was just talking about the emotional connection. He's got the emotional tone of now, which is this kind of unfocused wistfulness and this unfocused sadness, which never actually steps out and says, this is what I'm sad about or this is where my problem is. That's where Father John Misty is really interesting because he lines them all up and says very explicitly, this is what I'm really pissed off about right now.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what's connecting with people, that it's just kind of template-y. Mm. You know, you can kind of, you can key into it without ever really
But also it works
committing.
as a whole piece,
yeah.
You know, which is unusual, so you can, and it's the sort of thing that does pay off listening to a whole album, which is, there's not that, you know, that's quite an unusual place to be at the moment, I think.
Yeah, I remember everybody going nuts about the last one and saying how fantastic it was until somebody piped up, what are you doing? This is basically Dire Straits. Whereupon the response was, what's wrong with Dire Straits?
With Dire Straits? But you know, but that's an interesting point. What's wrong with Dire Straits? One of the few bands to have escaped full rebirth.
Yeah.
Into acceptable society,
which is why people who like them really, really,
exactly.
Never, you know, it's that there's no kind of. I mean, there's no point for like.
If you're Mark Knopfler, you think, well, I've done all these things, but you write one Walk of Life, and people will never, never let you back in.
Okay, well, that's A Deeper Understanding by The War on Drugs, available. I think it's out now, available now. Okay, let's move on. Rob Fitzpatrick, it's your turn to choose some music. What have you brought in?
Well, I went to the other extreme and went to a literally brand new thing by someone I had never heard before in my life. And this is one of the great joys of now, I think, is that you can be presented by something that you've never heard before, by a band you've never heard before, didn't even know existed, and then you go, fuck, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay, and so this is the Bell Game, and this is a track called Spirit.
That was Spirit by The Bell Game, as chosen by our guest, Rob Fitzpatrick. So we're going to finish off with Linda's movie roundup in a minute, because she gets to see far more upcoming movies than any of us do. But first, we're going to do something a bit off-menu, a Mexican sci-fi horror movie. Ordinarily, we'd give you a taster from the soundtrack, but it's all in Spanish, so there's no point to that.
So Rob's going to reenact it.
Yeah. Linda Marrick, what is The Untamed all about? If you can explain this in a sentence, you'll win a prize.
To a family audience, Linda. Okay. Family audience.
So, The Untamed, a body horror / social commentary movie.
Not another one.
Exactly. By a Mexican director called Amat Escalante, who won Best Director at Cannes in 2013 for Heli, which was a beautiful film about the drug cartel in Mexico. And The Untamed is about...
Spit it out. It's a Mexican tentacle porn film.
It's dirty, isn't it? It's dirty, isn't
well,
it, Linda?
It's a creature feature, basically. Creature feature about this tentacled monster that will, I mean, honestly, it's very difficult to even...
Have you every which way till Sunday, I think, is the phrase that you use.
Well, the gist of it is that we're in a very kind of nondescript Mexican city.
And yeah, it's rural Mexico. Really,
yeah. And you've got a kind of a decaying marriage and a problematic family and all the ingredients for a social realist drama.
Yeah.
And then in a
Paging
shed...
Ken Loach.
Yeah, it's and then in a shed on the court, you know, out in the fields, is a space
a
creature,
yeah.
Which is I think the best description. It'll give you some good loving.
Yeah,
yes, some really basically. Really good loving.
Whether you want it or not,
to the extent that you don't really want to do anything else. Mm-hmm. And so it is essentially a Ken Loach movie with a David Cronenberg sex monster in the middle, isn't it? Really,
it is. Yes,
Ken Loachenberg.
Yeah. Ken Loachenberg. I've never seen anything like it.
I haven't, but at the same time, I'm not sure I want to again. I'm a big fan of Escalante. I think he's a brilliant director. I think he really understands what he's working with. I did have some issues with this film because I simply did not care enough about his characters. Whilst, I don't know if you've seen Heli, I actually really felt really attached to every single person in that in the film. With this, I just think, I mean, I interviewed Amat about a month ago, and he explained to me that he was originally going to make a film about just what happens to the, in the story, he read a clip in a newspaper about this gay man who was found murdered in a river. And there was a derogatory headline about, you know, instead of saying he was a nurse who helped loads of people. So then from that, he came up with the idea that the man would be having an affair with the sister of his, the husband of the sister, of his own sister. And he wrote a first draft of the film, as a, you know, straightforward social realist movie, and then for halfway through it, decided I don't think I want to make a film just straightforward social realist movie. Yeah. I think I'm going to put a monster in it, and not entirely sure that it needed it. But you know, I don't know. You guys tell me what you think.
It's a queasy watch. It's about, the pace is incredibly slow. I mean, I was without...
Not all of it.
Put me film pons hats on. It was a little bit like Stalker, the Tartovsky Stalker movie, where you just enter this alien territory.
Yeah.
And the pace of the film is completely unlike anything you're used to, so you have no idea what to prepare yourself for.
Yeah.
The alien tentacle sex monster appearing at the Reading Festival.
Three more from them later.
Yeah, three more from them later. Alien tentacle sex monster appears infrequently... Makes a big impression when it does. But what it's really about... I mean, I thought the alien tentacle sex monster works as a metaphor for the fact that sex is... In these small towns, sex can be the monster that destroys everything. You know, when you live in it... You know, we live in London where there's loads of stuff to do.
Yeah.
There's a reason why the television schedules are littered with stories about suburban sex scandals where there's nothing to do. And this is taking and literalising that beyond words.
I think his initial idea was to talk about sex being... repulsive as well as a good thing. So yeah. I think you're repulsed.
Very true.
You're repulsed by what's happening with the monster.
TMI,
at the same
Rob,
time,
TMI.
You want to keep on watching.
Yeah.
You know, there's he's influenced very much by Andrzej Zulawski, the Polish director, also by Dario Argento. He's the kind of director who has really done his homework in when it comes to horror. But at the same time, I'm not sure. I mean, I didn't really. It's not that I didn't get it. It's just that I didn't care enough.
It's a fantastic curio. I mean, it reminded me. There's an amazing science fiction short story called "And I Awoke and Found Me Here on the Cold Hill's Side" by James Tiptree, who is actually a woman, and that's about the aliens come and the aliens are so sexy that human society falls apart. We are just obsessed with the aliens. They're so sexy.
They're too sexy for their show.
They're too sexy for their
tentacles.
Yeah. So I thought there's a little bit something in there, but it's a really really interesting curio. When's it out?
It's out Friday.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So. If you want to take somebody on a date to a Mexican...
It's definitely a first date movie.
Yeah, absolutely, first date movie.
Yeah.
So, Linda, we mentioned we're going to do your quickfire movie roundup.
Okay.
tell us, you know, I'll tell you the name of the film, tell us what's happening and is it worth seeing.
Right, I'll tell you the first one that I really, really want you to all go out and see, which is God's Own Country.
Okay.
So, small British movie, directed by Francis Lee, first-time director. which is being kind of sold to most people as being the British Brokeback Mountain. But I think it's so much better than Brokeback Mountain. It's about gay farmers. A young British farmer.
That's in this comic, isn't it? The gay farmer.
Great, like young British bacon. Farmer.
Yeah.
And a Romanian farmhand meet. It yeah. sounds simplistic, but it's absolutely beautifully filmed, beautifully acted, really touching, funny.
Which part of the country does it take place in?
In Yorkshire. Beautifully done. And I just can't wait for everyone to go and see it. So and to me, like, it's probably in my top five films of the year.
Huh?
Yeah.
There we go. Well, on Ilkley Moor, Bart Trousers. It's, God's Own Country. All right. Tell us about... Now, the big one for next week is Detroit, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I just absolutely love Detroit.
For listeners who are not entirely sure what's going on, give them the quick précis.
Right. So it's the Catherine Bigelow film, mm-hmm. which is basically based on the famous Algiers Motel incident during 1967, during the years of race riots in Detroit. I'm not entirely sure whether I should give too much of what happened, but it's something really awful happens between these young black kids who are just having a party in the Algiers Hotel and some racist cops who decide to fuck their shit up, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's beautifully, it's very long. It's a bit longer than it needs to be, probably, but it's beautifully directed, beautifully acted by John Boyega is in it. Will Poulter is absolutely terrifying in it.
Is that former Son of Rambo?
That's him, yes. Yes,
he was a little kid in Son of Rambo.
Absolutely terrifying. Brilliantly, I mean, he does, I mean, you don't even notice that it's him until sort of halfway through the film as a racist cop. There's already been a little bit of backlash because that's what happens nowadays, you know. But I think she's done an absolutely beautiful job in... you know, bringing the era back. I think it's really, really well done.
Well, she's basically the custodian of American history now.
Absolutely,
isn't she? The
Hurt
Locker's era, Dark 30, now this. I mean, she's like the non-shit Oliver Stone.
Yeah, she captured the era how you would see it, and to the point where, I mean, there's some footage from the era mixed up with her footage, and you can't even tell the difference because it's so well done, so well rendered.
Yeah, I think we may be doing it in more substance next week when we finally get to see the thing. So I mean, looking forward to that. I've had a soft spot for Catherine Bigelow ever since she did New Order's Touched by the Hand of God video.
I do. I love her. I think she's a brilliant director.
Now, a ghost story.
Oh, God. Now, a ghost story. What can I tell you about a ghost story? Another one of those films that are not that easy to sort of, you know, speak about in just in one sentence is the new David Lowery movie, which is perhaps the hardest film to describe for a critic because it plays around with... things that are not concrete. It's a philosophical film, really, about the study of lost legacy and the need to be connected to the other person. It's about this guy, basically, who, young couple, live in beautiful sort of ramshackle house in the countryside, and suddenly, unfortunately, something awful happens. And I don't know, if you don't want it spoiled for you, switch off now.
There's a ghost, and it's the ghost of a dead person.
Exactly. He dies, but instead of moving on, he comes back and haunts the house and stays in the house. And things happen around him. Eventually, even when his wife, or girlfriend, the person who he's in love with, and that's why he came back to the house for, she moves away and he stays on. And this goes on for a few... I think it's really difficult for me to explain this without someone...
Without ruining it.
Yeah, without ruining it.
But an impressionistic picture. Is it worth seeing?
It is absolutely worth seeing. Definitely 100% worth seeing. Yeah, it's. I mean, some have described it as being a sort of a Derridean sort of study of loss and death and love. You know, that's it.
one last thing, because Matt's given me the wind up the show thing. But... You mentioned Step as a documentary you think everybody should see.
Yes, I did, actually, yeah.
What is Step?
Documentary directed by Amanda Lipitz. Mm-hmm. Basically, it takes place in a school, an all-girl school for mostly African-American girls in Baltimore.
Yes.
And what the school does is they basically take these girls and hope to achieve 100% result in sending them to university.
So it's a hot house school.
Yeah. to sending them to university. Alongside this narrative of sort of working hard to get to university, there's the STEP class. The STEP, which is, I don't know how to describe this, but basically kind of like, almost like a voguing kind of class, and the girls are alongside trying to achieve to better themselves, basically, want to also win this step competition. And it's beautifully uplifting, really funny. What it reminded me of, you know, lately to sort of make it a socially aware film, people always feel like they have to make it heavy. What I liked about this is it was jubilant and joyous. It reminded me a bit of être et avoir, you know, to be in, to have, yeah. You know, it's kind of
or
goes
even
back.
Educating Yorkshire.
Yeah,
So this educating yeah, Baltimore.
Exactly, educating Baltimore. I mean, it just goes to show that you don't have to be that heavy or serious to make a film that has a message,
okay.
Basically.
So our instructions are, Linda's instructions are, go and see Detroit, A Ghost Story, God's Own Country and Step. And then if you've got a strong stomach, go and see The Untamed. And that's pretty much the end of our show, which means it's time for Closing Time Chatter, where our guests tell us what's been obsessing them this week. Rob, what's been obsessing you this week?
I've been obsessing over the idea that nostalgia is the cocaine of emotions. It's something that sort of weaves in and out of my mind a lot. I went to see a very famous group recently at a big venue, and I found it sort of profoundly depressing for a lot of different reasons. But one of them being the idea that pop music has been reduced to this thing where it's just a thing that you go and you watch and you sing along with it, and you're just venting your own memory through this thing. And it's, in a way, it's kind of eaten and destroyed. It's basically destroyed rock music. I think there's the narrative of worship in rock music, and the elongated way that 50 years later we're still obsessed with the bands they were obsessed with when they were teenagers has sort of destroyed what rock music could have been. It's become jazz. It's become a thing that's locked in a certain thing.
So you're basically just re-experiencing everything.
Yeah, really, but people necessarily, yeah, and they do, and it's understandable why people want to revisit their emotions, and it taps them in a certain way. It's like looking at old pictures, and of course, there's a, but you wrote a very good thing many years ago about that when iPods came along, and how an iPod, because you can immediately access those records in a way that you couldn't, that music in a way you couldn't before, and this is still true, obviously, you can burn out those memories. You can burn out those synapses.
Yeah.
And so my answer to this problem of this, that sort of cheap but hollow way of just kind of trying to tap into who you were 30 years ago and trying to just get a little fraction of a second of memory, what it felt like to be a teenager or whatever, is to develop nostalgia for a thing you had no part of in the first time round. Mm. And there's a very quick and simple way to do it.
Listen to records you hate.
Well, no, but it's along those lines. And basically what it is what you do is very simple. Go to Google Books, go to Billboard, right? You've got 50, 60 years of Billboard online, easily searchable. It's the most incredible, incredible research tool, or just fun tool for a kind of pop nerd. Go in there, think of a record you really love, put it in there, find out the sort of contemporary writings about it, and then look around the other stuff that was around that week or that month or whatever. And look at the stuff that was in the, you know, the R&B charts or in the disco charts or in the jazz charts or in the new age charts or in the pop, whatever like that. And to look at the things you didn't know about, but the things were of that time as well. And then soak up some of that. And it's a way of accessing something.
Wasting a day.
Well, yeah, it is. But it's a wasted day. But it will open you up to a load of new stuff. But it will also, it also gives you an insight into a different life that you didn't have.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's, for a lot of people, that's what watching the old Top of the Pops has done, because you tend to think, wow, 1983, it was amazing because ABC and the Human League. But then you watch it and it's like, bloody modern romance.
Yes, rubbish.
And loads of old crap, awful crap.
But you see,
which is more instructive than the stuff you know and love.
But that's also, but that's exactly, but you see, the difference between those two things is that Top of the Pops has been very heavily curated and very heavily targeted. It's the hits, right? And it's but the thing about the Billboard thing is you've got a kind of 100-page magazine that just wants you to buy whatever the thing is.
Yeah.
So some things that were massive, and loads of things that have just died and were never be heard of again. But they're all there, and so many of them are on Spotify, people, and you can just listen to them and see what they were, and things that were came and went in the blink of an eye, but they are of the same, they share the same air that the things that you already loved and you've nearly burnt out
on. So basically, we should go back and enjoy the hits of 3:15 on Tuesday the 14th of February 1981, rather than just the stuff we like. We should go back.
Well, go back to wherever you like. I mean, it could be, but the thing is, all of us love, we don't just love music that came out when we were teenagers. We, you know, we love music of all sorts of different, but obviously there's a certain piquancy to those older things. But it doesn't just have to be 1981. It could be, you know, 1966. It could be 1973.
Interesting thought. Linda Marek, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
Right. Mine is the backlash. The film Backlash.
Are you starting the backlash against the backlash?
I am starting a backlash against the backlash. What has really annoyed me this year, and it's been like this for the last couple of years, film comes out, gets rave reviews from everyone, then a columnist gets hold of it and basically completely destroys it and doesn't get the film. Someone who's not film literate, and this might make me sound like a complete dickhead for saying this, but completely missing the point of the film and just launching an attack on it, and which really annoys me.
Can you give us an example there? Tell us, I mean, well, what I can think of one, which was La La Land, which I very much did not expect to enjoy, loved.
Absolutely love La La Land.
And then 5 minutes later, you've got people telling you why it's problematic.
I'm going to go into a tirade now, because I absolutely love La La Land. I saw it for the very first time at a press screening during the London Film Festival, and loved it. People cheering, you know, screaming, laughing, crying. Comes out, and I think it's partly because the film company tried to sell it as a rom-com rather than selling it as a beautiful sort of art piece.
It's a rom-trage, isn't it, really?
Exactly,
rather than a rom-com.
It's an art piece. It's dummy. It's people, you know. It's not a straightforward Hollywood movie. What annoyed me the most about it is you had people say comparing it to Moonlight, which is like comparing oranges to apples, which is absolutely ridiculous, creating this kind of false polemic against La La Land by comparing it to a film that is very worthy, which I absolutely love. I mean, I adore Moonlight, and I really like, I'm very glad it won the best Oscar. But at the same time, because the two are compared, I mean, I've even read people saying it's a racist, La La Land is a racist movie because the jazz musician in it is white. What? How ridiculous is that? Are white people not? You know, it angered me so much, and I even almost lost a really good friendship over it, because I just kept saying, stop saying stupid thing about films, you know, like, because it's a popular thing to say.
Yeah. Well, a friend of the podcast and frequent guest, Doreen Linsky, sort of wrapped up a lot of the current approach, not just to film, but to entertainment in general, by saying, you'll read all these pieces, and essentially what they say is, why that thing you really like is politically suspect.
Thank you.
The brief for an awful lot
for
of
pretty much everything,
and film and culture writing.
But that in essence, speaks to the fact that we live in a world, in a sort of clickbait world. So that would never have happened 10 years ago, because 10 years ago there was no money to be made in having that opinion.
From saying stupid things in public.
But now there is. So you know, take something big. Oh well, that thing you like, this is problematic. Well, what do you mean it's problematic? Click. Oh, there you go. Yeah. There's some money.
No more backlashing. The backlash against the backlash has started. Yeah. Matt, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
Well, it kind of touches on what we were talking about with the rave. Documentary earlier, and it's the BBC has recently, BBC Radio 2 has recently done a special on pirate radio. But once again, it was pirate radio from the 60s of boats and the ship that rocked and all that kind of stuff. And I just think I just got very cross while listening to the trails on Radio 2. I really love the BBC. I think what it does is fantastic. But there's a massive hole in their willingness to punt a much more interesting story and relevant story and a story that's got an effect on what's going on now in terms of the pirate radio that happened in London especially, but also around other parts of the country in the kind of 80s and 90s, which essentially led to dance music's takeover of the charts. It led to a massive kind of explosion of youth culture, and things like Kiss and LWR and Sunrise and Galaxy just don't ever get the props that they deserve.
I've got to say,
and also the difference is that what you're talking about is a really interesting documentary. What could be a really interesting documentary about how pirate radio. Let's deal with Tony Blackburn on a ship really quickly, and let's move into something that's relevant to where we are. And that, you know, that's the birth of those stations and the birth of, and also the creative. What I think misses, and this is one of the things that the Acid House thing, lots of these things miss, is there's the sheer energy and creativity needed to get that shit going. Yeah. Especially when you come from a place where you're not given those things. is astronomical and to even think about. But then also it has a life in the sense that those stations, there are still stations.
Yeah.
There are loads
like
of great 150
stations
now
out there
that are still basically pirate, that serve particular communities, that are more vibrant, that do more, play more interesting music, have more interesting presenters on them than anything you will hear anywhere else. And those are interesting stories to tell.
And the thing is, what we were saying about the problems of that documentary, and that there's no or very little video footage. You know, there are the cassette, everyone's got cassettes, or a lot of people that I know have got, and there's lots online of cassettes of DBC, of LWR, of Westwood on these, you know, first pirate radio, of the original Kiss FM. And it's just, I don't like calling this, but it's, I think a lot of it is down to race. You know, it's a lot of it is down to that fact that they were black stations.
Do you think it's also down to the fact that buried deep in the minds of commissioning editors is an unconscious conviction that the most important things all happened between 1966
and 1972, which is why...
And nothing else really matters, everything else is a sequel.
What I didn't say when we were talking about and where there's a lot of things, problems that were wrong with that House documentary, the good thing is that it's starting to be considered now by commissioning editors.
The good thing is they're doing it.
Yeah, precisely,
Okay, well, my closing time chapters, I've got two, actually. Firstly, it happened while we were away.
We weren't allowed two.
Well, no, don't worry, one of them won't make the cut.
I'm in charge, and I'm going to say them in a way that Matt can't edit the other one out.
Four.
One of them is R.I.P. the iPod, which died while we were off-air. The iPod, which I loved dearly. I'm going to miss a single-use device. I don't want my phone to do absolutely everything. I reckon.
Why don't you want your phone to do absolutely everything?
Because
why not?
The phone is huge, and I don't want to have to have it in the gym. I want to have my little tiny iPod.
It gets full very quickly.
Yeah,
as well,
and it does everything. And also, people ring you up in the middle of listening to things, or you get alerts in the middle of a tune. It drives you up a bloody wall.
But then if you had your iPod on...
I like my iPod. And I think that file-based music is going to be the new vinyl.
That reminded me of something I wanted to mention that I didn't mention.
Well, you can mention it in a second. Once Apple finally closes down the download side of the iTunes Music Store, once it goes all streaming, and once you're basically into a battle between you on Spotify and them, files, MP3s will become the new underground Samizdat swappable thing, because the first thing you realise is not everything's on streaming. You know, I've got a good 40% of what's on my hard drive is not available on any streaming service. It's just crap I've collected over the years, things I've digitised. And I think there will be a new iPod invented by somebody else. And it might not be as beautiful as the Apple iPod, but it'll be a thing for people who love that different way of listening to music. So that's my one closing time chatter. And my other closing time chatter, which Matt is not allowed to edit out, is two great pieces about the decline and the disappearance of the bad review. He's miming scissors here. You can't put this out. Basically, whatever happened to the bad review, the real tour de force kicking. One was by Luke Turner in Crack magazine and the other was in the Wall Street Journal. I'm going to post both of them on Facebook. And it's just going back to what we were talking about earlier, the validity and the point of the review. I used to love a really good kicking because it's entertaining. Yeah. There's no point delivering a kicking to some band you've never heard of. Don't put delivering a kick into some making their debut album on their own crappy little label. Who cares?
Punch up rather than down.
That's just bullying. Yeah. But when a giant act puts out a truly dreadful record, somebody's got to call them on it, and nobody wants to because
nobody does.
They're frightened that they're going to not get the interview. They're frightened that they're going to offend the social media kind of mob. There's a fear of.
I don't think it's that, and I think that actually what it is was called succinctly by R.L. Powell, David Hepworth, who what happens is that people review the bands that they like and they get commission, and they want, it's a new album by whoever, new album by Arcade Fire comes out, the person who likes Arcade Fire goes, I'll do that, and they like it, and so you end up with a magazine full of three and four reviews because people just want to review the things that they like.
I want to read 5-star and 1-star reviews.
Yeah, I'm only,
because
they're
the most fun. Genuine enthusiasm, genuine informed enthusiasm, and real stuff.
But then there's a whole thing to be done about, you know, horrendous 5-star reviews of our time.
Perhaps
you
we know. Can come back to that in the
later
podcast.
I think there's the same thing in the film reviewing world.
Perhaps we can return to this at a later date, but for now, we're out of time. That's our show. Thanks to our guests, Linda Merrick. Thanks, Linda. What are you up to next?
London Film Festival coming soon, and which I am going to be covering for Hey You Guys. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen the full programme just yet, but I think there are some really good films in it.
Jolly good. And Rob Fitzpatrick, thanks for coming in. What's the next exciting thing that's got us to Spotify?
Well, I've got three new shows launching before the end of the year, are all quite exciting.
What are they called?
Can you tell us?
No, I can't. No, it sounds really boring. But no, I will tell you very soon. Okay. But yeah, they do
as well.
So I'm making shows.
Plug them on here. Excellent. Listeners, please remember you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth and on Spotify as well. You can subscribe in the podcast section via Apple Podcasts and on Spotify as well. And you can follow us on Twitter at @big_mouth UK, but not on Spotify. Thanks again for listening. And we'll see you all again next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
You probably can follow on Spotify, can't you?
You can't follow Twitter on Spotify.
No, you can
follow Twitter on Spotify through my Instagram.
Yeah. And,